ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Arts in 30, your weekly digest of arts and culture news from across the globe. I'm Sky Kirkham. Halit Tabsabi is once again Australia's representative to the 2026 Venice Biennale after the Board of Creative Australia reversed their previous decision to cancel his invitation. Elizabeth Ann McGregor, the former director of the Museum of Contemporary Art Australia, will be my guest. She says that instead of shying away from controversy, a strong agency would embrace it and work to engage the public. But after an independent review that spoke a lot about risk management, what will happen to Creative Australia's appetite for risk? And this week, a major collection of Emily Carmen Nguari's art opens at the Tate Modern in London with more than 70 pieces. It's the first exhibition on this scale of her work in Europe. We'll find out more about the woman behind some of Australia's best-loved art. But first, the headlines with Luke Sidham-Dundon. Luke, welcome. The jury in the trial of Sean Combs, aka Diddy or Puff Daddy, has returned their verdict.
Sky, he's best known as a hip-hop star and founder of Bad Boy Records. He's been found guilty on two counts of transportation to engage in prostitution, but he's been acquitted on the three most serious charges. There's one count of racketeering conspiracy, usually a charge reserved for the mafia, and then there's two counts of sex trafficking by force, fraud or coercion. Now, the two charges that he's been convicted of each carry a maximum jail term of 10 years. So there's a theoretical maximum of 20 years. That seems pretty unlikely, though. The prosecution is pointing to guidelines that seem to recommend a term of slightly more than 5 years, and his legal team have argued for a significantly shorter term of imprisonment, especially given he's already been in jail since the end of last year. Combs was denied bail pending sentencing, with the judge stating that it's impossible for the defendant to demonstrate by clear and convincing evidence that he poses no danger. Sentencing is expected to take place in October.
And Luke, what else is making news this week?
Well, Gareth Sansom has won the Sorrento Art Prize, which at $125,000 is the richest in the country. The judge, Emeritus Professor Sasha Grishin, described Sansom's painting, I'll Go Anywhere, as having the rare quality of possessing both the immediate Andy Warhol wow factor and the slow burn that opens up different levels of meaning as you enter the painting. An exhibition of the finalist is on display at And Gallery in Sorrento until the end of August. Then Australian musician Joe Camilleri, perhaps best known for his work with the Black Sorrows, has had 9 guitars stolen from his home in Victoria. That includes a 1954 Gibson Switchmaster and a 1956 Gibson L5. Now, he's told the ABC that if the people who took them are smart enough, they'll be in a container on their way to Dubai right now. The thieves allegedly also stole cutlery, a leaf blower and a wheelie bin. You really hope that that's not where the guitars end up. Elsewhere, the best-selling Irish author Sally Rooney has told a British court that the government's decision to proscribe the activist group Palestine Action could prevent her from appearing in the UK. Rooney wrote in a court document that I am and will continue to be a committed supporter of Palestine Action. If that support is criminalised, I will effectively be prevented from speaking at any future public events in the UK, since I could not in good conscience disguise or lie about my principles in public. Now, despite Rooney's statements, the High Court has refused to temporarily block the ban against Palestine Action while a larger legal case is mounted. To the US, California has raised the yearly limit on tax credits provided for film and TV from $330 million to $750 million. The bill follows intense lobbying from Hollywood after fires and strikes and increased subsidies in other locations have significantly reduced the amount of on-location filming in the state. To Africa, where the Museum of West African Art, which is based in Benin City in Nigeria and was first announced in 2020, has put a date on their first public exhibition, November this year. For their debut, the museum is presenting Nigeria Imaginary Homecoming, which is expected to build on Nigeria's pavilion at the 2024 Venice Biennale. And then Australian actor Julian McMahon has died at the age of 56 after a valiant effort to overcome cancer. That's according to a statement from his wife. McMahon, who was the son of Australian Prime Minister William McMahon, rose to prominence on Home and Away before moving to Hollywood, where he appeared in shows like Nip Tuck and Charmed. McMahon recently appeared in The Surfer as the leader of a gang that terrorises Nick Cage, but audiences around the world might actually know him for his most recent performance in the Netflix show The Residence, where he played the dashing Australian Prime Minister. He was really brilliant in that role. And then lastly, Michael Madsen has died of a cardiac arrest at the age of 67. The actor was a regular collaborator of Quentin Tarantino's, beginning with the iconic role of Mr. Blonde in Reservoir Dogs. While he never quite broke through to leading man status, Madsen appeared in more than 300 productions and lent a memorable presence to every role that he took.
Luke Sidham-Dundon there with the headlines. And you can catch Luke on RN Breakfast every weekday here on Radio National or anytime at all on the ABC Listen app. You're listening to Arts in 30 on Radio National. I'm Sky Kirkham. In February this year, Khaled Sabsabi and Michael D'Agostino were announced as Australia's representatives to the 2026 Venice Biennale. Days later, following an article in The Australian, questions in the Senate and an emergency meeting of the board, that invitation was withdrawn. Following an external review and months of campaigning by their peers, the artist and curator are once again Australia's representatives to the Venice Biennale. It's a story that we've been covering on this show for almost the entire year, and after a drama that's cost multiple people their jobs, damaged Creative Australia's relationship with the arts sector, and muddied the reputation of a respected artist, it's wonderful to finally have some good news. At the same time that news was announced, Creative Australia released an independent report into their original decision to first select and then cancel Khaled Sabsabi and Michael D'Agostino. The report found that there was no single failure of process, governance, or decision-making, but that there were a series of missteps, assumptions, and missed opportunities. What lessons should Creative Australia take from this series of missteps? How can it build, with confidence, a vibrant visual arts sector that embraces the needs of the artists and of the broader community? Elizabeth Ann McGregor is a curator, an art historian, and was for many years the director of the Museum of Contemporary Art Australia. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here in such happy circumstances, thank goodness.
Are we basically back where we were 5 months ago, or how much has changed despite the result being the same for you?
Oh, I think a lot has changed. I have to say, I think the way the decision, the rescinding, let's get it clear, the way that the rescinding was made in such an atmosphere of panic, it was very clearly, I mean, what the report doesn't address actually too much is that it was happening in the run-up to an election. So a very febrile time when, you know, there's lots of point scoring going on in the media, and I think that contributed a lot to what happened. So things have changed. I mean, the fact that Creative Australia did cave in, as it were, to that atmosphere, didn't stand up for the artists, didn't go through some basic steps of ensuring that everybody involved knew what they were taking on. I know the curator, Michael D'Agostino, and the artist myself very well, and I know that they were well aware that there could well be attacks on them, given that he is a Muslim and that he has in the past made work that can be misinterpreted. So I think the missteps is a very polite word of saying that they got it really badly wrong.
The acting chair of the board of Creative Australia, Wesley Enoch, told RN Breakfast recently that some of these issues are coming up at such a rapid pace that the systems that were relevant to us even 2 years ago are no longer fit for purpose, I suppose in reference to the idea that there is a difference with the Archie Moore decision. Do you agree that things have changed that much over the last 2 years?
I think that we are in a very difficult time, but we've faced controversies before, quite frankly. I mean, there have been attacks on artists by various, vested interests, if you like, in various ways. But yes, I think in terms of the intensity of it, I think he's right. It has this particular situation in the Middle East which has resulted in both anti-Semitism and, of course, Islamophobia, both around the world, but particularly here in Australia. It's very distressing to see that. But the arts needs to rise above that. We need to recognise that artists have important things to say. And I would not have backed this artist if I didn't think that he was an artist who would do exactly that and was not there to provoke, deliberately provoke and cause hurt in what is a very difficult situation for many people.
You wrote in a recent article in The Guardian that instead of shying away from controversy, a strong agency would embrace it and work to engage the public. What would that look like in comparison to what we've actually seen over the last few months?
Well, first of all, and I've actually done a bit of a check about what happens in other countries, you have to respect the independent experts who make the decision about which artist should go. Almost every country appoints a panel of experts, museum curators, art experts, whatever, people who know about the world of contemporary art. And sensible people, they're not young artists who are going to say, let's just, you know, toss it in and make a bonfire and blow everything up. It's not what it's about. It's about selecting the right artist at the right moment for the country. And most all independent experts take that very seriously. So the idea that that can be overturned by some kind of panic response or any kind of response, even within a risk analysis framework, which is one of the things this report goes on about, you really can't have that. You have to respect that independent experts. People in the media may think, you know, they're entitled to their opinion, absolutely, but they are not, I'm afraid, experts. And if that makes me an elitist, well, so be it. You know, I've dedicated my career to creating that bridge between artworks and a wider public. And I think an independent expert is the person who makes the decision, who makes the recommendation. Ultimately, Creative Australia, as the commissioner, the institution is responsible, but it should not fall on the CEO to be the final arbiter, in my opinion.
Mm. There is, as you pointed out there, and perhaps understandably, a lot of discussion of risk management processes in the independent report commissioned by Creative Australia. But can art be governed by the standards of risk management? What was your approach when you were managing a large gallery?
Well, we always knew, we never thought about it before. I mean, before we made the final decision, we would sit down and talk through what could be the responses. But we never knew what would happen. I mean, I had a board once when I was working in the UK say to me, please, you know, tell us in advance if there's going to be an uproar. Well, I can't. All I can do is tell you what the work is and what my view of it is. But the way it gets manipulated by the media is something I can't control. So a very controversial exhibition might get no attention, and then out of the blue, something that I would have thought was quite non-controversial suddenly becomes the front page of the newspapers. So it's very difficult to judge it. But at the same time, you can actually make sure that your board and your funding bodies are well informed, particularly when it's pretty obvious. And the selection of Khaled himself said he was surprised. So it was pretty obvious that there would be people who would criticise this decision. So you take appropriate steps. You know what the answers are. You make sure your team's well briefed. You make sure that everybody understands fully why you're backing this artist. And you go into it with your eyes open. I always used to say to the curators, do not give me any surprises. I need to know, if we're choosing artists, that when the Daily Telegraph or whoever it is rings me, that I can actually answer and back the work. It's the important thing. And that's what Creative Australia unfortunately failed to do in this case.
The opposition spokesman for the arts, Julian Lisa, had this to say about Creative Australia's decision on RN Breakfast.
I think Creative Australia's made the wrong decision. A representative of Australia on the world stage should reflect our values, and to reinstate this artist as our representative at the Biennale and to give them taxpayer funds, I think flies in the face of those values.
You've said that you do not believe that there needs to be a distinction between artistic freedom and Creative Australia's responsibilities towards the wider community. But can that remain true when one side of politics continues to take that line towards Mr. Sapsabi's work?
Well, I would like, obviously, I respect opposition spokesman's views, but has he ever seen the work? Has he ever engaged with the artist? You know, anyone can have an opinion, that's fine. But actually making decisions, who's to say that he doesn't represent our values? I mean, that's a little bit problematic, I have to say, because I know him very well. And I don't think that an artist of his views, a Sufi artist, necessarily should be considered as somebody who's in some way un-Australian. I mean, he is someone who's lived here, dedicated his life to being part of our artistic community. The fact that he has strong views on certain things is fair enough, but he doesn't always put them out in his work. It is extraordinary to suggest that one person's view of this should actually predominate over everybody in the sector, as you've seen coming out and saying this artist should represent Australia. It is a good step to have an artist of his background to represent Australia. It is not against our values. So I would strongly disagree with what he said.
Michaela Tai resigned as the head of visual arts at Creative Australia in protest at the decision to rescind the invitation to Khaled and Michael. That was more than 4 months ago. I've asked Creative Australia whether they've filled the role. As far as I can figure out, no one's been put into the role. It hasn't been advertised. Does it matter that there's no one in that role at this time?
It totally matters. It matters that there aren't strong voices throughout the council, quite frankly, that can advocate for the visual arts. I mean, this often happens when sometimes out of ignorance. You know, I'm not blaming, you know, the board or even the senior management. They don't know that, you know, if you're confident and you know about working with difficult work, which all of us who've worked in the contemporary art sector know, these things hit us not frequently, but from time to time. And there are many people who are experts in doing it. Michaela Tai was one of them. You know, she ran galleries. She had a distinguished career as a curator. She understands both the artistic side of it and the community side of it. The role of the head of visual arts, I'm not sure what they call it nowadays, but it used to be the director of visual arts, is critical to be able to reflect back to those who may be not as confident about how these things could and should be handled without provoking the kind of outcry that we saw.
Elizabeth, one final question for you. In that recent article in The Guardian, you also noted that you have long thought that our regional galleries play a vital role in engaging audiences with new work. What have you made of the recent Create New South Wales funding round, which saw fewer than 18% of regional galleries successful in their bid for ongoing funding?
Oh, it's tragic. Absolutely terrible. You know, I don't know what's going on in New South Wales. I haven't been following it very closely, apart from that I know they've downsized the agency itself. But our regional galleries, I'm now living in the regions. You know, I was at Coffs Harbour the other day. There's a magnificent show by Patricia Piccinini, Caroline Rothwell and Jules Kitson and Team Lab there. It's incredibly important to these galleries. They play such an important role in the community, and they do a whole range of work. You know, not all contemporary art is provocative, let's face it. I mean, some of it deals with difficult issues, but there are other works that deal with other issues of the day, whether it's the environment or whatever. So I feel that we really need to value the regional sector. The reason why I said that is that we have in this country, I found when I came from the UK, a very siloed approach. You know, you have federal funding, you have institutions that are owned by the states, institutions that are owned by the federal government, and then you have so-called independent institutions that are owned by nobody. And that's quite siloed. And instead of these agencies all working together, there's a tendency for things to fall through the cracks. I know that Michaela Tai did amazing work, you know, bringing back the ethos of working together with the states to decide how funding should be allocated in certain ways. And we need more of that. We really need more of that. And we need less of this is mine and that is yours, and more a kind of collaborative approach. The early Australia Council review was only on the galleries that they already funded, in other words, the independent sector, and I feel that's a mistake. You need to look at the whole sector, even if you don't fund it, how do they intersect? Because if you take one bit of it out, if you defund a gallery, as happened a few years ago, where they managed to defund 40% of the independent galleries, you take a critical part of that infrastructure out and lots of other things flow on from that. So we need an agency that looks at the whole country and works with the different agencies and the different funding bodies and the different levels of government.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for your time today.
Not at all. Thank you.
Elizabeth Ann McGregor is a curator, an art historian, and was for many years the director of the Museum of Contemporary Art Australia. On ABC Radio National, you're listening to Arts in 30, your weekly digest of arts and culture news from across the globe. I'm Sky Kirkham. Emily Carmen-Ngware is one of Australia's most renowned artists and one of the most expensive. Her painting, Earth's Creation, sold in 2017 for more than $2 million. Well, this week, a major collection of Ngware's art opens at the Tate Modern in London with more than 70 pieces. It's the first exhibition of this scale of her work in Europe. She's also the subject of a new documentary, Emily, I Am Karma, which tells the story of her art, of her country, and of her life. Danielle McLean is the documentary's director. Danielle, welcome.
Thank you.
So who was Emily Ngware? She wasn't just an important artist. She was a senior figure in her community, a very important figure.
Yes, so she was a senior woman of the Ulalgra ladies for Ulalgra country. And she took part in ceremony, obviously, as a young woman. And then as a senior woman, painted women's bodies and held on to stories and past stories for, you know, to the next generation, and dances and songs. So she was a really significant cultural figure in that community, but also an amazing artist. Her work obviously moved from kind of her cultural world to the canvas.
And it's so interesting that the work most of us know her for, that work on the canvas, only came very late in life, didn't it? It was condensed over a short period.
Yeah, that's right. It was about eight years of her life. She'd done a batiking for 11 years before that, but then she moved on to canvas and with acrylic paint, but she produced up to, it says, 3,000 paintings in that time. So she worked hard, but from all accounts, it sounds like she needed to paint.
And the work is truly remarkable. One of the things that stood out to me in your documentary was you were talking to her kinfolk from that country and showing them the work, or they were seeing the work, and they had such a deep understanding of the paintings. And it made me realize how limited my own vocabulary is. I've seen some of the paintings. I love them. They're beautiful. They're wonderful, but I don't understand them at a deep level. And these women saw it and they knew the stories that were being told. What does it mean to see that understanding of the art? Sort of what are we missing, and how can we as a general audience gain that understanding? Or should we? Is it enough to appreciate it from a distance?
I think that was one of the things we tried to achieve with the documentary, was to give Emily and her community, the Ulalgra and Anangra ladies, their own voice around this, and to actually welcome us as outsiders into that community to gain a bigger understanding, a greater understanding of Emily's work. I mean, the reality is she is painting country and they know that country so intimately, like her. So what looks like dots and lines on a painting to us and lovely colours is really significant. And they're maps of land and country and how people move across them, how ancestral beings travelled across them to create those landscapes and stuff as well. So that those ceremonies pass through those places. So they know them so intimately, from when they're young girls to adults. They get more and more knowledge of those places and obviously pass that knowledge on to the next generation.
Yeah, and you've got some wonderful shots from the sky, but also really close up on yam roots and the like that take us into the land, into the country that she was painting. Was that your sort of trying to communicate to the audience what those paintings were telling?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was trying to, obviously, because we had her archival recording of her voice and stuff, we wanted to be able to, you know, we've worked with Dr. Jennifer Green to translate those recordings and stuff too, which she had made over a long period of time, knowing Emily so intimately. But you know, we really wanted to try to get that understanding of what these things mean, because, yes, they're the physical, they're the things underground, they're the yams, they're the seeds, but they're also about the creation or recreation and of those plants and animals and stuff. So, you know, the obligation to dance and sing for those things. So there's more of them on country and for the next generation, you know, it's it was a really interesting process, actually, just getting to be on country with the ladies and seeing how alive it still was.
This is an art story, but It's also a story of some of the biggest political moments of the last century in Australia. She was, you know, there alongside the land rights movement, a big part of that. The stolen children, stolen generation is part of the story you're telling here. How did you want to include the gravity, the wealth, the experience that she had beyond just the art?
I think as an Aboriginal person, being Aboriginal, you are political because all those policies affect your life so intimately. You know, the reality was her land was taken from her. She worked on stations. She worked, you know, for rations. She worked, you know, she fought for her land back. All of those things made her the person she was. And those old people were actually very political. They did get off their butts. They marched. They said, we're not accepting this anymore, you know. So that was part of her story. And I think her art is political in lots of ways too, because she's painting her country and she said, this is mine. I own this. I've got obligations to it and to my family, to my kinswomen. So I think it all actually is part of her story.
What does it mean to have this art going to what is basically the heart of empire? You know, talking back to the UK, to Europe in a way.
Look, I think that what you've just said is quite amazing, because I think the reality is it's trying to give people insight into how people see this country and their own country and their obligations to country and what drives them to protect country. So I think they are really great in this world that we're living in right now. It's really great to look at First Nations storytellers, but also, you know, landowners, community people that actually have got some of the answers and how we should be looking after our planet.
Yeah, 100%. Danielle, congratulations on the documentary and thank you so much for your time.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Danielle McLean there, the director of Emily, I Am Karma, which is screening this week on NITV and available on SBS On Demand. There'll also be a repeat screening on SBS later in the week. You're listening to Arts in 30 on Radio National. And every week, we invite an expert from across the ABC's music networks to showcase one special song just for you, our track of the week. And this week, C. Benedict, executive producer of the music show on Radio National and of Arts in 30, joins me. C, welcome. What is our track of the week and why should we be listening to this one?
Well, I have the new album from the Stiff Gins. This is called Crossroads. It's actually their fifth studio album, but they've been together for 26 years. So they're on their 25th anniversary tour, but kind of a year into it. This is a song that's sort of happens halfway through this album. It's called Something About a Cake Shop. And I saw before this album was released, the duo perform it live at the National Folk Festival as part of this set that I sort of intended to sit through about half of and then go to another set. And I just was totally like glued to my seat. They are so charismatic. Their chemistry is so amazing. The band that they were playing with, which is on this album as well, is just really, it's sort of tight, but it's not too tight. It's like fun. It's still fun. They are Kalina Briggs, who's a Wiradjuri Yorta Yorta woman, and Nadi Simpson, who is a Yawuluri woman and a author as well. I think a lot of people probably read her first novel, Song of the Crocodile. She has a new one called Bellbird. She was also a Ngarrindjeri composer last year or the year before.
So she talented. I read the book. And I was aware of Stiff Gins, but I'd never put together that it was the same person.
Yeah, she is a huge multi-hyphenate, incredible. Kalina is also a beautiful, beautiful artist. The way that they have been working together, so Stiff Gins started as a trio back 26 years ago at Eora College, the sort of Indigenous music college in Sydney, and they worked originally with Emma Donovan, and the two of them have just continued on, and they tour a lot. It's really kind of easy to catch them at a gig. Their songwriting is very beautiful, very delicate. There's a mixture of kind of, you know, sort of old-fashioned English language Australian storytelling songs and some beautiful language from both of their mobs. And it's just, it's great songwriting. This song is quietly devastating and has a great chorus. And I highly recommend listening to the whole album because it's a really nice piece of work.
All right. Well, I am ready to be quietly devastated. C, can you throw to our track of the week, please?
This is Something About a Cake Shop by the Stiff Gins.
Best to wake then check yourself out of bed. Walk away and leave the sorrow. Find warmth instead. Around the corner, only a block away.
No.
That was Something About a Cake Shop by Stiff Gins, the track chosen by C. Benedict. And that's all the time we have for today. Arts in 30 is produced by me, Sky Kirkham. C. Benedict is our executive producer. Tim James, our sound engineer. And if you're enjoying the show, let a friend know or leave us a review if you're listening on a third-party platform. It's an important way to help spread the word. I'm Sky Kirkham, and I'll catch you next time here on Arts in 30.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.